Generations of Americans got used to going to the doctor when they didn't feel well and walking out with prescriptions for antibiotics that would kill the bacterial infections that ailed them. Over those generations, the creatures targeted by the antibiotics adapted. Now, what were routine infections easily cleared out by antibiotics linger, unaffected by many of the drugs we've come to rely upon. This is the situation Matt McCarthy takes up in his book Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. It gives a history and a look at a human trial he's been a major part of. Matt McCarthy is an MD and a teacher and writer, an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College and a staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He's written other books, including the bestseller, The Real Doctor, We'll See You Now. Matt McCarthy, good to have you on The Exchange.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
So the title of Superbugs alone is scary. How widespread are the germs that are unaffected by antibiotics?
This is a controversial question to start off with. We have challenged sometimes even defining what a superbug is. Some people say it's just drug-resistant bacteria, but then there are guys like me who take a far more broad look at it and say that it also includes drug-resistant fungi and parasites and viruses. And if you include all of those, this is one of the biggest public health issues we face today. In fact, the World Health Organization just said that superbugs are going to be a bigger killer than heart disease or cancer by 2050. It'll be 10 million people per year that are going to die from these drug-resistant microbes that are expanding around the world.
So it goes far beyond bacteria, then. You're saying viruses, parasites, fungi, all part of the mix as well.
That's exactly right.
And not just medicine to blame, you point out. Remind us how agriculture takes a role in the development of superbugs.
Well, there are problems large and small with how we're using antibiotics that have caused the superbug crisis, really. On the large scale, it's that we use antibiotics in agriculture, as you mentioned. For example, in the orange groves in Florida, which is where I grew up, we use antibiotics that were designed to treat syphilis and tuberculosis. And that's because it helps the crops and the yield of the crops. We also use them in meat-producing animals, things like chickens and pigs and cows, and we use them in tulip gardens in the Netherlands, and people have sampled the soil around these gardens and found that they are just rich with superbugs. And so that's sort of the big-scale problem. And then on the smaller scale, doctors like me inappropriately prescribe antibiotics, and patients don't always take them as directed. And all of those things put together have exposed the bacteria and the fungi to our precious arsenal of drugs, and that it's allowed them to mutate into these superbugs. And that's what we're fighting here today.
You begin, the vignette that starts the book is you treating a gunshot victim with an infection, and only colistin would work. What are the dangers of using that particular drug?
I started with that anecdote because that's an antibiotic that fell out of favor 20 years ago. Nobody was using it because it was so outrageously toxic. Yet here we are bringing it back because it's one of the few antibiotics that can kill a variety of superbugs. And if you go on social media, you'll see infectious disease specialists who are tweeting out saying, are people still really using colistin? Is this drug still what we have to be using? Because I don't feel good about it. And the reason they don't feel good about it is that it can chew up the kidneys, it can cause neurologic side effects, and all sorts of problems that we are having to discuss with patients now because they have infections that are so difficult to treat that we're reaching for this drug that fell out of favor a decade ago.
So the treatments now are potentially somewhat destructive themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so the challenge we have is that we're running out of treatment options, and the pharmaceutical industry that we've traditionally relied upon to help us make new drugs, they're losing interest in this market because the profit margins are so slim.
Wow. So it becomes a profit story, too.
Well, that's right. What you would think that with just the supply and demand, if there is a demand for new antibiotics, that they would supply them and make money off of them. But there's a problem here, which is that antibiotics are only prescribed in short courses, and doctors are stingy about doling them out. And even the best new antibiotic is eventually going to wear out its welcome when the bacteria and fungi mutate. And so it's very different to produce an antibiotic than to, say, produce a blood pressure drug where a doctor says, take this every day for the rest of your life. And so there's this fundamental problem that antibiotics aren't used very often, even if they're very powerful. And that's hard for the companies who spend billions of dollars producing them. It's hard for them to make back their investment. And so increasingly, we see the big players, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, Allergan, they're pulling back and they're saying, we don't want to do this anymore. And that is couldn't be happening at a worse time because, as I note in the book, superbugs are spreading everywhere.
So, Matt, is there a life expectancy when you roll out an antibiotic? Is there an expectation for how long it'll be useful before the bugs catch up to it?
Well, what's so interesting about these bugs is that some mutate immediately. Something like staph mutated very quickly to become resistant to penicillin. But then another bacterium or spirochete called syphilis, it hasn't mutated much at all, and we can still use penicillin 75 years after it was introduced, which is so interesting to me that some conditions we'll be able to use the antibiotic for generations, and for other conditions we'll only be able to use the antibiotic for a couple of years. And all of that becomes very challenging and confusing to these pharmaceutical companies that are trying to turn a profit. And they say, you know, we're just going to use our expertise to do something else. And that's something that I write about what should we do next. And there's a host of proposals on the table. Some of them are financial enticements to get the companies to stick around and make antibiotics, things like giving them a tax break so that they can use the excess profits to create new antibiotics. Or there's an emerging argument that we should nationalize the production of antibiotics and that the federal government should do it. That's controversial, but that's what experts are increasingly starting to discuss.
Well, when you get to a point where nobody wants to make them because they can't make money out of them, you have to look for other options. We'll get into what some of those options are, talk about the human trial that Matt McCarthy was involved with in testing a new antibiotic. Our guest is Matt McCarthy, an MD and an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York City, also staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. He is on the front lines in medicine, obviously, and has also been taking part in a human trial, has been leading a human trial to develop a new antibiotic. He's talking about why antibiotics don't work that well anymore in a book called Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about bacteria, fungi, parasites, and viruses and their resistance to all the things we throw at them now. 800-838-3760 by phone for your questions and comments. Emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. The history lessons are really instructive in Superbugs, Matt. How old are the mummified bodies that show traces of tetracycline?
Oh, that's an incredible story. You know, several thousand years old, if not older. One of the things that I really enjoyed doing researching this book was looking at how humans have been using antibiotics for millennia, whether they knew it or not. And we have evidence of that by going back to looking at the mummified bones of Egyptians and people from the Sudan and other parts of Africa, because inside those bones are antibiotics like tetracycline. And it was evidence that the humans of antiquity recognized that there were certain foods that they could eat that contained trace elements of these antibiotics that could protect them from infection. And it wasn't until much later, really until the 20th century, that we figured out what these chemicals were and how they were protecting us. And more importantly, we figured out how we could find them. And that's, another part focus of my book is, I talk about the spread of superbugs, but the exciting part of it is that we are finding that there are antibiotics all around us. And many of them are found in the soil beneath our feet, and that there are little microorganisms that are engaged in subterranean warfare, and they're creating all these chemicals to kill everything around them in this Darwinian survival of the fittest. And people are trying to isolate and pluck out those chemicals and turn them into life-saving antibiotics for humans. And that's really the cutting-edge forefront of where science is going right now, is targeting where do we look for the next great antibiotic. And it proves to be a rather challenging endeavor, but there are people using big data and artificial intelligence to figure that question out.
Once we had a name and a technique, antibiotics, and this is post-World War II now, how fast did their use grow?
thought was incredible. So the first commercially available antibiotic was penicillin, came about in the mid-1940s, and that ushered in what we call the golden era of antibiotic development, the 1950s. And it seemingly every couple of months, a new life-saving drug was pumped out, and the human life expectancy ballooned during this time. But then something happened, which is that a number of prominent scientists came out and said, you know, we got this infectious disease issue kicked. It's time for us to focus on more pressing issues like heart disease and cancer. And so the pharmaceutical industry shifted its focus to these very lucrative conditions. And that was a strategic error, because at the time that shift occurred, the superbugs were just starting to mutate and evolve. And it wasn't until the 1990s that we recognized the scope of the problem. We recognized that, you know, there were hundreds of different superbugs, and we were playing catch-up, trying to create new drugs to treat them. And that's a game we've been playing for the last 30 years, really, of catch-up to come up with new treatments.
So we essentially fell 30 years behind, we're saying, in antibiotic development.
Yep, that's exactly what happened.
Wow. So we might have had new effective antibiotics by now if research had stayed focused?
Well, it's easy to, you know, hindsight is 20/20, sure. But there was a strategic error that we did not put the right resources into it. And now a lot of the companies are saying, you know, it's just so expensive to create an antibiotic. It typically takes 10 years of trials and $1 billion, because if you discover that molecule, let's say in the dirt, you've got to show that it kills bacteria in a test tube, and then animals, and then healthy human volunteers, and then humans who have superbug infection. And that is pulling all of that off is a high wire act. And many of the companies that do this are saying no thanks. And they point to a company called Achaogen, which had an antibiotic called plazomicin approved in June of last year to great fanfare. And everyone said, oh, my goodness, we've got this new great antibiotic. And the company filed for bankruptcy 9 months later. And it's because doctors weren't using the drug. And so they say, we cannot take this kind of financial risk anymore. And that creates a unique challenge for us right now, is creating enticements for these companies to stick in the antibiotic game.
So, Matt, how does the federal research apparatus help, National Institutes of Health, any of the structures that exist at the federal level for assisting this kind of process?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they are very good at identifying talented scientists and funding them lavishly. And if you talk to the people who run the NIH, they say, we do discovery science very well, but you do not want the federal government to be a pharmaceutical company. That these companies have perfected many of the aspects of purification and quality assurance and all kinds of things that we tend to not think much about that the federal government is not designed to do. And I quote Anthony Fauci in the book. He's one of the thought leaders of infectious disease, who says you do not want to go down this route of nationalizing the production. But then you talk to a lot of smart doctors out there and researchers who say this is the only path forward, because antibiotics are a market failure. And we need to look at them like a public good, like electricity or water. And these are not things that we should be thinking about profit margins with, that we should pool our resources and, you know, go with the European Union or with China or whoever. We could all put in a huge pot of billions of dollars to create the next generation of antibiotics, and we could all share them and disentangle the profit margins from this, you know, crucial aspect of public health. And that's something that's, you know, it has not been asked of any of the politicians on the campaign trail, but you will be hearing more about this in 2020, that the antibiotic market is broken. What is your plan to fix it? And that's something we need to ask all of the candidates.
Matt McCarthy is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange at MD in New York City and the author of the book Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. We have an email here from Don and Eugene, who wants to know about the evolution of vancomycin, he says, an antibiotic being evolved to treat other things.
Yeah, so that's something I talk about in the book. Thanks, Don. Vancomycin was initially known as Mississippi mud. It was discovered by a missionary in Borneo in 1952, looking in the soil, and it was very quickly sent back to the United States. Eli Lilly purified it. Took a while to purify it. The name vancomycin comes from the word vanquish, to defeat. So we're defeating the bacteria. And in just a matter of a few years, from when it was discovered by this missionary to when it was being given to patients, it proceeded through the regulatory approval process, and it has proved to be one of the most reliable antibiotics that we have. The problem is that its efficacy is waning now, and that it's one of the antibiotics. I'll tell you, I prescribed it this morning, seeing patients, but it's not quite as strong as it used to be, because the bacteria have developed all kinds of incredible mechanisms to evade it. And in the book, I write about some of these really ingenious things they do. They've created things called efflux pumps, which are these microscopic vacuum cleaners that suck up antibiotics and spit them out. And they've created enzymes that can mince up any antibiotic. And so what we have been looking to do is to fool them. And we come up with what are called Trojan horse approaches to drug discovery, where we'll say, oh, this bacteria likes to eat up iron. What if we attach an antibiotic to iron so that the bacteria swallows the iron and with it swallows the antibiotic as well? And we're finding that that's a really exciting and innovative new way to kill the superbugs. And so it's, you know, always trying to stay one step ahead of these things. And vancomycin was one of the first antibiotics that we saw that the superbugs were evolving to be resistant to.
Well, let's bring in dalbavancin, because this is the drug that you've been working on for quite a few years now. Give us a brief history of its development and where that stands.
Yeah, this is interesting. So dalbavancin was designed really to replace vancomycin. It's a drug that has the same sort of treatment effects, like it can kill MRSA and a lot of the bacteria that cause skin infections. But there is a problem. The nice part of this drug is that you give one dose and it stays in your system for 2 weeks. The problem is that the company charges $4,000 a dose, and many hospitals, including mine, said, we are not going to pay a ransom for this antibiotic. Vancomycin is good enough. It only costs $40 a dose. And so what I did was I ran a trial. I convinced the company to give me a bunch of the dalbavancin for free and to use on my patients. And I wanted to see if there was a way that we could that it would be so effective that it would pay for itself, and that it would benefit patients and the hospital and everyone involved. And, you know, one of the themes in my book is that pulling off a clinical trial with a new antibiotic is a really difficult thing to do. And I look at it sort of from a 360-degree angle, from the regulatory and oversight issues, which is that I almost didn't get my trial off the ground. Because the board that was reviewing my proposal was so reading it with such a fine-tooth comb that we spent almost a year just going over the wording of various paragraphs. And then once you do get approved, you know, it's a delicate thing to go up to a stranger and say, would you like to try this new drug? And I write a lot about the difference between consent and informed consent. And I found that I was quite good at getting consent from patients, but I didn't always know how informed it was. And that's something that really kept me up at night, frankly, and something I think that people should know more about. You know, the next time you're in the hospital, a doctor may walk up to you and say, hey, would you like to participate in this clinical trial? And I wanted to have sort of a guidebook of what that could mean for you.
All right. Well, we'll parse the difference between consent and informed consent in just a bit. We're talking to Dr. Matt McCarthy about his book, Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic. It's a conversation you're welcome to join on the Jefferson Exchange. Phone calls go to 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Ethics do loom large in superbugs. I can tell listeners that. I mean, you do step back in time at this point in the book when you introduced dalbavancin to remind us of horrible Nazi drug experiments and the terrible work at Tuskegee on syphilis. There are safeguards to prevent abuses in research now, correct?
Oh, absolutely. absolutely. You can't, as a researcher, you can't just walk into a hospital with a new product that you found on the internet and say, I want to, you know, start treating people with this. There is a group called the Institutional Review Board, or IRB, that will review any research that involves human volunteers and make sure that it is being done in an ethically appropriate manner. And that's true for anywhere across the United States. And that is a response to the appalling ethical lapses that doctors of prior generations have committed, really. And I think it's a necessary one moving forward. So, yeah, this is something that's tightly regulated throughout the United States and throughout the world.
Even so, knowing all this history, it sounds like it put you in a bit of a twist when the IRB would keep deferring you.
And those deferrals were agonizing, but they were a necessary thing for me because I found that running a trial, it really meant something to patients to hear that it had received the blessing of the hospital. And so, you know, by the end of the story, I have a new appreciation for what that means and what they have to go through to ensure the patients are cared for safely. And that's what, you know, an area of my research now is on human experimentation and what that means for doctors and for patients.
There's a great line in the book in which you say, whenever I'm frustrated by the slow pace of drug approval, I remind myself of Frances Oldham Kelsey. What did she do to earn your admiration?
This is a great story. Well, back in the 1950s, there was this new drug that was being created that was supposed to help people sleep, women to sleep and lose weight, and to help really with the nausea of pregnancy. And this woman, Frances, who worked at the FDA, was not convinced that it was entirely safe. And she received a tremendous amount of pressure from private companies that wanted to bring this European drug to the United States. And she said, I'm not going to approve this until I know that it's safe. And she did some experiments and found that this drug was actually crossing the placenta and could affect the unborn children, the embryos. And that drug turned out to be thalidomide. And she saved thousands and thousands of birth defects throughout the United States simply because she was unwilling to bend to pressure. And, you know, having those safeguards at the FDA are crucial. And they can be a thorn in my side when I want something to move more quickly. But as you quote, I have to recognize that there are times that it's really important to have a thoughtful person who's unbiased in the process reviewing any new drug that may come out, you know, in the coming years. And we've got a number of drugs in the pipeline now to you know, address superbugs, and I wish that they were coming out more quickly, but there is a slow and necessary procedure that takes place to make sure that what you give, that you receive as a patient or what I give as a doctor is indeed safe.
Let's take a call here. Connie in Eugene, welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Matt McCarthy, the author of Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your putting the time and effort into the research for this. My question is sort of two-pronged. Antibiotics and bacteria get a lot of publicity, but fungal infections are everywhere and more diverse and invasive and destructive than people are willing to admit, I think. And so if you would address some of the problems with treatment of fungal infections. And then second to this is the problem with any organism of identifying what actually the patient is sick with and the problem of sort of broad-basing treatment without knowing exactly what the patient is infected with. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Connie.
Well, Connie, those are great questions. My particular area of expertise is actually fungal infections. I'm the editor-in-chief of Current Fungal Infection Reports, so we are every couple of months pumping out articles about all of the emerging drug-resistant fungi that are killing people. And if you think it's difficult to convince a pharmaceutical company to make a new antibiotic to treat bacteria, it's 10 times as hard to get them to make a new drug to treat fungi. And one of the challenges we have is that as the climate changes, we have a number of fungal infections that were previously geographically localized. An example is blastomyces, blastomycosis. It used to be in the southeast United States, and we're now finding it in upstate New York, which is a totally novel finding, and it's going to be a potential new pathogen for people who have never been exposed before. So absolutely agree that fungi are underappreciated in the world of superbugs, and I made a point in my book to write extensively about a new superbug that's a fungus called Candida auris, which was discovered in the ear of a woman in 2008 and quickly spread around the world. And then the second part of your question was about the diagnostics, really. And this is something that is also underappreciated, that to truly confront superbugs, you need to have novel treatment options, but you also need better diagnostics. And to tie it into your question about fungi, many of the fungal infections that we diagnose today, we're diagnosing by looking under a microscope. It's the same way we were doing it 100 years ago. And the diagnostics have lagged behind because they can be so expensive, and it's not always clear who's going to use them. And the companies are skittish about investing a lot in a novel diagnostic platform that may or may not be used. So, Connie, excellent questions. I'm right there with you.
All right, and clearly a lot of pressures then against developing new antibiotics on the whole process of diagnosing the things that antibiotics work against. We'll talk about some of the specific issues with the superbugs themselves and how they have done this bit of evolution over the years. Matt, help us understand the mechanisms a bit. The superbugs themselves, in addition to just mutating, are they mutating faster? Are they getting better at it?
Yeah, that's one of the scary parts of this, is that they're getting, it used to be, to evolve or mutate to avoid antibiotics came with a fitness cost, which meant that they got weaker in the process. And now we find that that's no longer the case. They're getting stronger and they're getting smarter, and they're not becoming weaker when they turn into superbugs. And that's something that has been sort of an active area of research, trying to figure out why this is. But the short version is that bacteria are constantly exchanging DNA with each other. And if there is a segment of DNA that makes an enzyme that can chew up antibiotics, they will pass it along to each other very quickly, and it will spread around the world, and that makes something that's very hard for us to keep up with. And so it keeps epidemiologists and public health researchers on their toes, trying to track the latest sequence of DNA, which is known as a plasmid, how those plasmids are spreading.
So it really is an arms race, but as you point out in the book, you don't want to amass a huge arsenal all at once. Why?
Yeah, that's right, because if we accept the fact that the bacteria and fungi and parasites are always going to be mutating and always going to be evading our newest drugs, we don't want to release 10 at the same time, because then we'll run out of them quickly. What we want is a steady drip, so that we could release one every 2 years, say, for the next 20 years. And that's something that I think we by necessity will end up having to do, because it is so daunting to go through the FDA approval process. But the good news is there are lots of different drugs in the pipeline, and scientists are discovering new antibiotics all the time. And it's a really exciting time for scientists and for microbiologists.
Are you concerned, though, that even if science gets everything right, that the market and the functions of it and the way that drug prices tend to get jacked up might get in the way?
Well, you know, I quote a pharmaceutical CEO who raised the price of one of his antibiotics by 5,000%, and he said that he had an ethical mandate to do so because he's fundamentally accountable to shareholders and not patients. And that's a disheartening thing to hear, but it is important to recognize that we've got lots of different options here. And I think the first step is just to become an engaged citizen and to recognize the problem, look at the different proposals that are on the table, so that a year from now or 3 years from now, when you hear, here's a new solution to the antibiotic crisis, you'll be able to sniff out whether that's a good proposal or a bad proposal. And that was really the reason that I wrote the book. And I should mention, I'm going to be in Oregon next week, speaking at Powell's Books in Portland.
Oh.
And at Oregon Health and Sciences on the 30th. So if people have questions that they don't get to in this segment, I'll be out there.
Well, do you know what day you're going to be at Powell's?
Tuesday, the 30th.
Tuesday. Okay, good. So in a week. DALBA, has the whole marketplace thing had any effect on the DALBA trials?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Before I ran the trial, my hospital said there's no way we could use this drug. And then after I ran the trial, they unanimously approved it. So there is some inertia, I think, with adding new drugs where people look around, you know, the hospital administrators look around and say, is anyone else using this thing? Is it safe? Is it effective? What do we do? And that's something that I think is okay as a policy, but it's not the best policy. We want to be on the cutting edge and innovative and looking at what are the promising new drugs and how can we use them responsibly. But my trial has led to many new trials with experimental drugs to figure out, you know, why is it that we have so many patients who, when I walk into the hospital in the morning, who are suffering from these infections? What can we do about it, and how do we bring them treatment options immediately, rather than waiting years and years for things to proceed sort of at a slow, sluggish pace? Like, we've become very impatient with trying to save these lives.
DALBA shows that it's effective against MRSA, that's the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. I mean, where is MRSA generally found?
Well, it's all over the place. That's the scary thing. When I was in medical school, we were taught that it was primarily in gymnasiums and in nursing homes. And now it has spread all over the world and all over the United States. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times 2 months ago where I mentioned that 5% of healthcare workers have MRSA in their nostrils. And there's a big difference between being colonized with a MRSA or having an active infection. To be colonized means that it's just living on your skin harmlessly and that it's not causing an infection. But if the skin barrier breaks or if your immune system suddenly weakens, let's say from chemotherapy or high-dose steroids, that MRSA colonization can turn into an active infection. And so we have very strict containment strategies and protocols in our hospital and all hospitals do to make sure the patients are safe. And one of the things we emphasize is that it's a far greater risk to avoid medical care because you're afraid you might pick up a superbug than it is to go into the hospital and to seek medical care, because doctors are, you know, on guard making sure that you aren't exposed to anything you should not be.
But the part that never makes sense to me is why it's so hard to get it out of places like hospitals, where you can obviously, you know, use some fairly strong disinfectants, I would think, on some of the hard surfaces.
Yeah, these things are going to be around long after we are, and they were here before us, and this is one of the things that's really challenged us. Is you can soak a room in bleach, and it doesn't always remove all of the infection. And, you know, with this new fungal infection, Candida auris, that I mentioned, one of the hospitals in New York City had to pull out part of their ceiling fans and their roofs and all kinds of infrastructure because the fungus was so hardy. And so an area that we are investigating now is, are there novel ways to disinfect a room with things like ultraviolet lights and blue lights and silver, all kinds of different compounds that can trick the bacteria and get rid of them. But it's a very challenging process.
We have an email here. All I can say is peace, because that's the name of the person's email, asking about just taking care of your immune system generally. And I believe Helga and Talent on the phone now has a similar point of view. Helga, welcome to The Exchange with Matt McCarthy.
Yes, you talk only about what the resilience of the microorganisms is, and you have not mentioned our own body's ability to surround invading bacteria and kill them. I mean, it seems like maybe if we had never had antibiotics, our body, you know, wouldn't need to fight these superbugs.
Right. No, that's a good point. So the human immune system is extraordinary. And one of the challenges that we've had recently is that there have been a number of really great new medications that have hit the market, monoclonal antibodies like Humira and drugs that can treat a number of new conditions that will treat a condition, but they will subtly alter the immune system. And that alteration predisposes people to infections. And one of the things that I have found in my years of doing this is that many of my patients with superbugs don't realize that they were at risk. And the easiest way to figure out if you're at risk is just to have a simple conversation with your doctor where you can just say, how's my immune system? Many people don't realize they have a medical condition that weakens their immune system or that they're on a medication that weakens it. And so that's a starting point. If you're somebody who has lived your life relatively free of infections, other than, you know, the seasonal runny nose, you're not somebody who should, you know, walk around being terrified of having a superbug infection. By contrast, if you're somebody who is, like my father-in-law, has a staph infection every 3 months, you've got to be much more alert and maybe don't go into the moldy basement to clean it out. And that's something that I think just starts with education and information. But you're absolutely right. The human immune system is one of our most important barriers against these infections.
Thanks for the call on that, Helga. So halfway through the book, Matt, you get to bacteriophages, which we talked about in April with Stephanie Strafty, who wrote the book, The Perfect Predator. How did the idea of bacteriophage therapy strike you when you first learned about it?
Well, I know Stephanie, and that's an extraordinary story she has with her husband. Bacteriophages are really exciting from the sense that they can be used to treat infections that antibiotics can't. The challenge here, again, is a market issue, that bacteriophages are a narrow-spectrum treatment. So they would be designed, they just saved a 15-year-old girl in London who has Mycobacterium abscessus infection. That's a very, very rare type of infection. And the companies who make these bacteriophages are going to have a hard time turning a profit under our current economic model. And so while I think the science is there and bacteriophages look like a really great treatment option, I'm not convinced that our current model would support it. That would be a place where nationalizing the production of bacteriophages might make sense. But again, I think that has to be a much broader conversation about how we want the federal government to support these life-changing treatments. But bacteriophages are really promising, and we're doing research here looking at other ways that we can use them to treat drug-resistant infections.
I also want to bring up another name in addition to Stephanie Strafty, which is Tom Walsh. We haven't talked about him by name yet, but he's a major figure in both the trial and the book. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so he's the guy I met when I started my infectious disease fellowship, who happens to be the world expert in fungal infections. And he's spent the last 35 years running clinical trials, bringing to market new drugs. And he's just a very special guy. One of these people who has a photographic memory but might not remember to tie his shoes. And he's been a very supportive mentor to me. And what I convey in the book is what that unusual relationship has been like. He will break off into a tangent in the middle of talking about a patient. We'll start talking about tactical formations from World War II. Or we'll start talking about classical music, and he's just a quirky guy, but he's one of these people who's dedicated his life to treating patients with drug-resistant infections. And that was one of the motivations for writing the book, was to inspire people to go into this line of work, because fewer and fewer doctors want to be infectious disease specialists. And again, it's an economic issue, which is that infectious disease doctors are often paid among the lowest of clinicians right now. And what they may not recognize is that it's such an extraordinarily rewarding specialty. And so I used Tom as a sort of an inspiration for me, and I hope for others as well.
So we mentioned, you broached the subject of consent versus informed consent. It sounds like you went through a couple of ethical permutations over the course of the trial. Have you reached a comfortable place now?
It's a case-by-case basis. Typically, what I've learned is to ask patients to explain to me their understanding of their participation in a trial, and you get a wide range of explanations from people. But what I'm really looking at is, what their understanding is. And one guy, I had a big stack of papers with all the different explanations of what the trial would mean, and he put it down and he looked me in the eye and said, I just have one question. Would you give this drug to your own mother? And that really simplified it, right? That kind of caught me off guard, but I said, yes. I hadn't thought about that, but that really got to the heart of the matter, is how much faith do you have in this product that you're asking someone to try? And that's a really scary thing to do, and I really thought that was a great question. And I've since incorporated that into conversations I've had with patients who are not sure whether or not they want to join a clinical trial.
So, Matt, we're down to our last minute here, and I have to ask before we go, when you look at the total landscape of efforts to defeat superbugs, are you confident we will gain the upper hand?
I am. I am confident. It's really just a question of who's going to pay for it. But the discovery is there. We're finding new treatments. We've got a number of new diagnostic treatments that are coming in down the pipeline. We just need to figure out if this is going to be something that's privately funded or publicly funded, because there's just too many lives that are at stake for us to ignore this. And I think the more people know about the problem, the more we can do to engage and to fix this problem, to ensure that we have the drugs we need.
All right, so Matt McCarthy, the author of Superbugs, The Race to Stop an Epidemic, and he is an assistant professor at Weill Cornell Medical College, staff physician at New York Presbyterian Hospital. And you're going to be in Portland, you said, at Powell's Books on the 30th.
That's right.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.